Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
As director of the Walter H. Capp Center for the Study of Ethics, Religion, and Public Life, I'm delighted to welcome all of you to this event. Indeed, the first of several events celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Peace Corps. Back in 1960, then-Senator John F. Kennedy, campaigning for the presidency, proposed the creation of an organization for promoting service, friendship, and peace in developing countries. And since then, almost 200,000 volunteers, 1,472 from UCSB, have given of their time and labor in this cause. Since then, thousands of organizations, non-governmental organizations especially, have arisen seeking to tap the goodwill of Americans, and especially of students, to consider careers in public service. The CAP Center is indeed one such organization. We now have internship programs in the nation's capital, in Sacramento, and here in Santa Barbara, serving nonprofits. Over the next year, universities across the country, in collaboration with the Peace Corps, the National Peace Corps Association, and its member groups of returned volunteers, are welcoming the 50th anniversary of the Peace Corps.
What a great opportunity for this community to come together to celebrate the commitment, our commitment to communities around the world and to what Peace Corps stands for. Particularly an honor to help pay tribute to the three honorees today. Sarah Chase, former NPR correspondent, prominent author and founder of Argand Cooperative in Kandahar, which I'm hoping we'll hear a bit about. Ms. Chase served in Morocco from 1984 to 1986. Gordon Radley to her left, the former president of Lucasfilms, who served in Malawi from 1968 to 1970, and Western Samoa in 1979. And our own Thomas Tighe, President and CEO of General Relief International, Direct Relief International, who served as Associate General Counsel of the Peace Corps and Chief of Staff and Chief Operating Officer of the Peace Corps. Mr. Tighe also served in Thailand from 1986 to 1988. And in addition, I want to recognize Santa Barbara's own Julianne Hyman, whose lifelong service to the Peace Corps, as was mentioned, began at its creation under President Kennedy in 1961, and who served as an impetus, I understand, for this celebration this fall from the CAP Center. I'm pleased to announce that just this week, in the House where I serve in Congress, we passed legislation to authorize a monument in honor of the Peace Corps near the National Mall. This commemorative will mark the lasting historical significance of the Corps and the ideals and values that it represents. So I'm optimistic that before too long, returning volunteers and all who support the Peace Corps will have a place which to direct their honor and their attention on our National Mall. Some of us are old enough here to remember the passion and enthusiasm of our President Kennedy 50 years ago when he announced the creation of the Corps. The idea that Americans from all different backgrounds, all different cultures, all different walks of life would have an opportunity to work for and to learn from other cultures. That was a fairly radical concept. And today, don't we marvel at how far we've come? Since 1981, as Clark mentioned, nearly 200,000 volunteers have served in 139 countries around the world. These talented and selfless Americans have made lasting contributions in agriculture, in business development, in sustainable infrastructure, in education, in health, HIV and AIDS, in environmental work, and on and on. Collectively, each volunteer's work represents a legacy of service that has become a significant part of America's history and our positive image abroad. I know I and everyone here is so proud of the work that is done, and humbled today to be amongst so many volunteers. These accomplished friends and neighbors of ours come from very diverse backgrounds here in our area. I'm particularly proud as well of UC Santa Barbara, which consistently provides one of the highest numbers of recruits for the Peace Corps. In the last 50 years, hundreds and hundreds of UCSB students have served. And when I have an opportunity to meet with folks from the Peace Corps Administrative Office and they know where I'm from, the first thing they always mention is the high concentration of ex and future volunteers from our area. I have testimony in my own congressional experience. I am a part of a bipartisan congressional group called Democracy Partnership, which works with emerging parliaments in developing countries around the world. And I've learned from experience in visiting these various countries and sitting with the parliaments and being part of the embassy's activities how vital the work of the Peace Corps is in each of these developing democracies. We are extending our own democracy in such vital and important ways around the world, tangible ways that will affect these countries, developing countries, for decades and generations to come. I've also been an ambassador. Some of the Peace Corps volunteers have been from this area, and so I've brought them gifts and household items that they need in their parents' well wishes, and oftentimes am able to bring greetings back home to them. And in our conversations, we always speak about the importance of maintaining federal funding for this valuable program. In fact, I heard a little lobbying about that today. So that the future, I take that to be a little lobbying from the audience here. I'm pleased to receive it. I have supported every measure that I can see ever in the direction of increasing our funding for Peace Corps. In my opinion, it's one of the vital parts of our foreign relations, and I'd like to see it continue to grow. I know we all want to support and continue to support this invaluable program and encourage our communities, our family members, and others to consider that this is something vital to the essential mission of our country and our role in the world. And one day some will celebrate the 100th anniversary, and we'll see it has grown even beyond this expectation that we have now. So I thank our guests of honor for their service, but others in the audience who have served yourselves, thank you for your service. Congratulations to the Peace Corps on this 50th anniversary, and look forward to the years to come.
Hi, everyone. Welcome tonight. I have to say I'm honored to stand up here as the Santa Barbara Peace Corps Association president, and I'm a proud return Peace Corps volunteer. I served in Chebokhsari, Russia from 2000 to 2002, and I have to say the opportunity to teach English and American history to a generation of students that came of age after the disintegration of the Soviet Union was an amazing experience and by far the best experience of my life. And I hope that the Peace Corps will continue, along with the current administration and future administrations, to offer these sorts of opportunities to volunteers and to America's future leaders. The Santa Barbara Peace Corps Association is an affiliate of the National Peace Corps Association, and locally we strive to achieve the goals of the Peace Corps. One is promoting a better understanding of the world's peoples through cross-culture community presentations, school visits, and site visits. But additionally, the Santa Barbara Peace Corps Association also provides support via its mini-grants program to assist active Peace Corps volunteers with projects in their countries of service. Recently, the Santa Barbara Peace Corps Association supported an HIV/AIDS education project proposed by two Malian university students in honor of World AIDS Day. The students worked together with the local Peace Corps volunteer to stage interactive HIV/AIDS education sessions, which were held in 10 separate villages and reached nearly 600 people. Another mini-grant helped to fund a project in Guatemala, directed by a volunteer from Santa Barbara named Laura. She oversaw the construction of a two-room school built of plastic bottles filled with trash in the village of San Miguel Dueñas, serving over 85 students. Her creativity and resourcefulness, emblematic of the best of the Peace Corps, was recently featured on ABC News. How many of you saw that? Did anybody see that? A few of you did. If you're interested in supporting our mini-grant program, please visit us in the lobby. After the panel discussion, we are selling tote bags, calendars, and T-shirts, and all proceeds will be used to support the mini-grants program to support more volunteers like Laura, Beatriz, and Jose, who are serving abroad. You know, finally, I'd like to recognize, and this was already done, but I'll do it one more time. How many of you here from Santa Barbara have served in the Peace Corps? Please raise your hand. Wow. How many from beyond the area? How many are nominees? Do we have any nominees tonight? Well, thank you for your service, and today's dedicated to you. Enjoy the program.
Peace Corps is an ethos. I mean, 70, 80% of you raised your hands. And I think it's about perspective. I think that's what I'd like to start with, really. It's about perspective, and I almost mean that in a physical way, perspective like vantage point. For example, you've got a problem or an event, you know, and people surround this problem or event or experience, and they see it differently depending on where they are situated with respect to that problem or event. And to me, what the Peace Corps really was about and continues to be about, and what it did to my life was standing with the people of the host country, or sitting with them, sharing their perspective of that event or experience that they were living through. Again, physically, sitting on the ground, eating food, your body becomes transformed by spending 2 years in an environment. Your body becomes that environment, you know. And then once you come to share the perspective in that way, it's your role to help bring some of the resources that we have here to bear on that event or situation. And I think we would, all of us, return volunteers, would probably agree that the experience meant and brought as much to us, if not more, as we brought or might have brought to our alleged beneficiaries. And so for journalism, this really infused how I did journalism. I would tend to live with people rather than stay in hotels. And I was always finding myself restive in the sort of journalistic canon which said you have to be, quote, objective, and that the truth lies in the middle. Basically, objectivity came to mean something akin to equal time. If you give, especially on the radio, you give 2 minutes to this side of the story and 2 minutes to that side of the story, you've been objective. And that never felt quite right to me. And what I found really amazing since I've left journalism formally, which I did in 2002, was that I do still, or have at least until last year, spoken out often in longer form articles or in interviews where I'm being interviewed. And what I always do is basically explain to the public where I am sitting with respect to the issue or the problem or the event that we're talking about. I am in this photograph, I'm in the third row from the back, six over from the left-hand side, you know, and from this vantage point, here's what I see. And I find that I've had a very positive reaction from publics when I do this. So Afghanistan, I went to Afghanistan as a NPR reporter. President Karzai's uncle asked me to stay behind and help. And I did it Peace Corps style. Even as a reporter, I lived in a family in a graveyard rather than in the hotel and things like that. And I stayed, and I've stayed ever since, basically. And I sit with people. When I say that, I think of an image. A friend of mine's mother passed away, and I went to the funeral. And I realized that people don't go to funerals. I mean, Westerners don't go to funerals that often. And there's a tradition, people say prayers at funerals, and they drop stones into a circle in the middle of the people seated for each prayer. You know, and so that's what I mean by sit with people. And what I've done most recently is found a cooperative, which Lois mentioned, which produces high-end skincare products for export. Interestingly, a lot of our raw materials exist here. I was hiking near Santa Barbara last year, and I'm reaching out and smelling artemisia and the wild anise that you have here, and there's almonds in the... And I'm saying, wait a second, it's time for an Argonne West, you know. But that was the point, is to expand the market for licit local agriculture in southern Afghanistan. We have men and women share in the decision-making process. The idea is to create a psychologically safe place that is reliable in an environment that is just kind of beyond description, particularly in terms of the psychological pressure. This is in Kandahar, which you may have been reading about recently. It's the, you know, sort of was the fiefdom of the Taliban during their regime. And my men and women, you know, occasionally come to work through body parts. Every day come to work not knowing whether they're going home or will arrive home again. And so I could speak for another 20 minutes or more about how you expand your business in an active theater of war. I won't do that, but this experience, I think, has given me a perspective shared with ordinary Afghans and indeed with the population from which the Taliban are drawing their recruits, that's quite different from that of most experts on the subject. So then we come to this job of mine, right? And I got a call in June. I'm in Kabul at the headquarters of the, you know, International Military Command there, where I'm working with General Petraeus. And I get this call from somebody who says, you know, they want to offer me a position, which is to be on the Peace Corps Advisory Board. And I said, wow, that sounds really great. And, you know, I start hearing about what the advisory board is being set up to do. And as the person finished, I said, well, just one issue. Are federal employees disqualified? And she looks through the rules and says, uh-oh, yep, you know, it's supposed to be independent. Federal employees aren't allowed, you know, to serve. And, well, what is it that you're doing with the federal government? And I said, well, I'm special assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I work in the Pentagon. And there was this stunned silence on the other end of the line and, you know, sort of, well, very best to you in your work. What I can say is that I've been quite astonished to find the degree of public service ethos among military commanders that I've encountered in the field, number one. Number two, you know, and this is separate from what one might think about the size or character of the military involvement in Afghanistan, but it was clear to me from 2002, the military is there, and we can't wish it away. Therefore, if you want to impact U.S. policy for the better, in Afghanistan or any other place where there is such a large military footprint, you can't do this to the military. You can't eat garlic and hope that they will, you know, flee, right? And so I engaged, I engaged with the military from 2002, from when they first got there, because it just seemed to me that you had to try to get through, number one, and number two, increasingly they were listening. And that's the other thing I find quite counterintuitive, is that when I say I've lived in Kandahar for 8 years, what they call outside the wire, military people sit up and listen. That's called boots on the ground time, and they respect that, especially in the environment that I've been in. Whereas what I find among a lot of civilians, particularly in Washington, is that it's about words. And if you can make your words sound plausible, then you have as much, you know, kind of a place at the table as somebody who has, lived the kind of experience that Peace Corps volunteers will live. And that also has been startling to me, that I'm a kind of folk hero among special forces in Afghanistan, you know, is something that I really have a hard time imagining. But it's about that. It's about the people who really do take the time and the effort to interact humanly and exchange, you know, as I say, the sort of physical aspects of life, the food that you eat, with the people that you're living amongst. And so that's how I got where I am now, and I can just say that the military that we have today is pretty remarkable in that they would bring, you know, Sally the Soapmaker, RPCV, you know, to be special advisor in the Pentagon. Thank you very much indeed.
First of all, I want to thank the CAPS Foundation as well for focusing on the 50th anniversary of Peace Corps and paying attention to that event. Out of the many things they could be focusing on, I certainly appreciate it because attention should be paid, and certainly they are doing that in the Santa Barbara area, and it's deeply appreciated for, on behalf of the Return Peace Corps volunteers, and I think it's important for America as well. In terms of the Return Peace Corps volunteers in the audience, I too want to thank you for your service to America and to the people with whom you worked and lived. Any of you could just as easily be up here in this lectern at this moment as me, telling this audience about what you went through. I was asked to speak on answering two questions. Why did I join the Peace Corps, and what impact did the Peace Corps have on me in the later part of my life? And again, obviously, this is a topic any of you could speak on with as much power and compelling answers as any that I could give. So on your behalf, I'm honored to speak and at least give my perspective on that. Why did I join the Peace Corps? You know, these are simple questions, but they're complex answers, and I'm sure they are for each of the returned Peace Corps volunteers, and it's not an easy answer. I think I have to start with my family. As was mentioned earlier, President Kennedy first mentioned the word Peace Corps when he was running for president in October of 1960. He spoke of it on the steps of the Michigan Union. He was about 5 hours late for a rally there with the students. My sister was a student at the University of Michigan and had waited 5 hours in the freezing cold for Kennedy. And so we heard about his remarks about the Peace Corps the next morning directly from my sister, before it really caught on in the attention of the press. So from the very origin of Peace Corps as a concept in certainly Kennedy's presentation, my family was there witnessing it. And then Peace Corps gets formed. I won't bore you with the whole history of it. Kennedy creates a Peace Corps by executive order in March, and they're still struggling to figure out what is this Peace Corps and what's it going to be and how do people serve. And, you know, Shriver had to go around the world getting countries to say, yes, we want to receive Peace Corps volunteers. And then they had to train them, and they had to recruit Peace Corps volunteers. And lo and behold, in May, my family saw my brother running down the street. We were sitting in a park, and he was quite excited, and we were all nervous something had happened, and he just said, I've been invited to train for the Peace Corps. Now, we didn't even know he had applied, and he was one of the first 14 Americans selected to go into Peace Corps training. He went into what was called Columbia One. They trained at Rutgers University, and during that whole summer that he was training, Congress was considering whether or not to authorize Peace Corps as a permanent part of our government and to provide funds for it, et cetera, because at this point it was still an executive order. So Congress people would be going from Washington to Rutgers and talking to these guys in training, and we would hear about it, of course, from my brother. And last week, on September 22nd, was the 49th anniversary of the passage of the Peace Corps legislation authorizing the Peace Corps. So it was September 22nd, 1961. My brother had just left for Columbia, I think, about a week before that. So all this time, I'm living the early birth pangs of Peace Corps as a young man, about 15 years old, back in Chicago, where I grew up. The following April, on Easter Sunday, April 22nd, my brother was the first American to give his life in Peace Corps service. He was killed in an airplane crash in the Colombian Andes, along with 38 Colombians. And that was obviously a very tragic event in my family's history. And it was also a significant event in the history of Peace Corps. I say this because it created a certain gravitas to Peace Corps service. It clearly demonstrated that going into Peace Corps, you ultimately were going to have to commit to the bottom line. You were putting your life on the line in service to the ideals that Peace Corps represented. And ultimately, you could pay the ultimate price. And so I think that first death, there always had to be, you know, the first. My brother happened to be the first. But I think the event of that death resonated within Peace Corps in a way that, as I said, gave a certain significance to the commitment of what Peace Corps service ultimately represents. So ultimately, my sister, the following year, she graduates from Michigan. She joins the Peace Corps and goes to Columbia, where my brother had served. And then I, in 1968, graduated from college. And so Peace Corps was something that was a part of my family history and legacy. But I think I went into Peace Corps. I know I went into Peace Corps for my own needs, I suppose, or for my own desires, my own purposes. I was certainly, after living a life in college of the mind, as it were, and the intellect and the academy, I was ready to get out of that world and engage the world and literally outside America on a very basic level, and to participate in something that had ideals that were greater than myself that I could really embrace. And the adventure of Peace Corps, there's no doubt about it, even to this day, Peace Corps is adventure. It is a huge unknown. You are leaving your culture, your country, everything, and you don't know what awaits you, and that is daunting, challenging, exciting, and all those kind of things were fascinating to me at that point in my life and very consistent with what I wanted to do. I went to Central Africa, Malawi, and I was in a program dealing with child health, improving child health, and our group was trying to improve the nutrition that's given to children, and doing that through a number of ways, but also by setting up what we called under five clinics. We would have well baby clinics in the United States. There we called them under fives, where you could see how the children are growing versus their age, give the mothers health, nutrition, education discussions, et cetera, et cetera. The program of which I was a part, I was placed alone in the most remote part of Malawi, 1 mile from Mozambique, and actually in an area where no whites had ever lived. And I lived with the Manganja and Sena people there who had had very little, if any, exposure to people from our world, and they were very traditional. But I was also working alongside two other Malawian Ministry of Health civil servants in a rural dispensary, which was basically a building with two rooms where we dispensed medicine being a aspirin if someone had malaria. It's pretty basic. But we set up these child care clinics. My job was to train these other Ministry of Health civil servants and set them up in the rural areas and the villages beyond the dispensary as well through mobile clinics, et cetera. Anyways, our group did what the classic Peace Corps dream is. We worked ourselves out of a job, which is what every Peace Corps volunteer is trained to do. And within our 2 years, we had trained enough Malawians so that our program, we didn't need to be replaced, and our program continued within the Ministry of Health. Just as an aside, I go back quite frequently to Malawi, to where I lived, and I love talking to people in the Ministry of Health today and telling them about the time when there were no under five clinics, and they look at me kind of blankly, as if there ever was a time when this kind of care and attention wasn't being paid to children. And I say that in this respect, and maybe I should have prefaced this by saying I want to talk about or answer these questions in three ways. Talk about Peace Corps as the job, Peace Corps as an experience, and then Peace Corps as the institution and a set of ideals. And I was describing just a few minutes ago the facts of the job that I was doing. But there was something else going on that's just as important, and I think Sarah alluded to it in her remarks. And the best way to me to illustrate this is soon after I got into this village and I was by myself, one of the young babies or child, about a year and a half, died, young girl. And I went to the family and I was talking to the father and I was extremely distressed because I thought this child didn't need to die. You know, it wasn't like the parents had done anything wrong, but there wasn't enough food. And it was in the microcosm, the problem I had come to deal with. And I was very upset and distressed. And the father kind of looked at me very patiently and in so many words said, you know, this is the fourth child I have lost. You didn't see and you weren't here for the other three, but they are as important to me and I grieve for their loss just as much as the one you've seen. And that's all he said. And it really, the wisdom I took from that was the degree to which I was carrying with me a certain ego, a certain need to make a difference. I wanted to make a difference. Every Peace Corps volunteer wants to make a difference. But I learned through the wisdom of, luckily, a villager that I was living with, that if I came to help with a big fat capital H, I was going to immediately put my people that I'm working with in a lower position. I was going to be coming to help them. I was going to be superior. I was coming with the knowledge these people in these villages were something less than me. And just because I saw that child die, and I experienced it, and I witnessed it, didn't make the problem any worse. And so through that, I began to realize the first job I had to do was to really learn how to live there. Now, I had a favorable situation, if that's the way to put it. These people were extremely traditional. The missionaries had never wanted to stay in this part of the world. David Livingston, of the famous Dr. Livingston, I presume, had traveled through the area, never wanted to stay. It was too hot. It's 130 degrees in the hot season. Lots of mosquitoes that you wiped off because there were so many of them. You wouldn't bother to kind of go like this. Consequently, these people had been left, quote, untouched, which was fascinating for me, being able to experience 19th century Africa. And they danced all night to drums because it was too hot to sleep. And when I first got there, you know, at first I'd stay in my hut, kind of afraid to go out. And then I got bold enough to be able to go out at night. And then I would kind of watch on the periphery and while they would dance in circles with these pounding set of 10 drums. And then I would observe and kind of say, okay, you know, I see they're doing that or whatever. And I felt enough confidence to say, all right, I'm going to join in. Well, I started to join in. They laughed. Here was this white guy dancing their dance or whatever they thought was going to be trying to. And it was, you know, not unexpected. But then they saw that I knew how to dance, that I could dance. I was savvy enough to have picked up enough of their traditional dancing steps to no longer have who I was get in the way of the experience that we were having. And it was through that dancing, even more than the fact that I learned their language or I ate with them and I worked with them and I spent my days with them, the fact that I met them at this very integral, intimate place of who they are, their ancestral dances, allowed me to see that the wisdom of Peace Corps, if that's the way to put it, is in this very interaction between this nice kid from the south side of Chicago going to Central Africa, overcoming language, geography, ethnicity, race, all these supposed barriers between human interaction, I guess what Martin Buber used to call or did call I-thou, to get into that kind of intimate connection was ultimately what Peace Corps was not only, it was not only necessary to get to that place to be effective in my work, but it was also the wisdom of what this Peace Corps experience to me is really all about. And when you start peeling away the onion layers, as I think any return volunteer knows what that means, and you start stripping away your culture and your language and your geography, and especially if you're posted alone, you don't have any other Americans to interact with, when you do then interact with the people you're living and working with, it's from a level or a place inside of you that is very open. And for me, it is that open-heartedness that is really, again, the wisdom of Peace Corps. I think all return volunteers, or all volunteers, have gone to the mountaintop, as it were, and seen a vision or experienced a vision of something that is a truth that is hard to kind of glean onto. You know, Thoreau went to Walden Pond to try and understand what life was all about, and he didn't succeed. He kind of came back early. He wasn't able to find it. I think, with all due respects to Thoreau, I think Peace Corps volunteers got it, and most of them get it. And in answering the impact Peace Corps had on my life, I could, and I thought about talking about all the international environmental foundations I'm on the board of and the NGOs I work with that are dealing with AIDS prevention and care in Africa and development issues and all of the Malawians I continue to interact with and the people I lived and worked with and their children and their grandchildren. But what I rather talk about is this truth that is the part of every Peace Corps experience. The last letter my brother wrote about 2 weeks before he was killed, he quoted a German philosopher, William Steckel, who said, "It's better to live humbly for a cause than to die nobly for one. And I think, obviously, Steckel's not talking about, when he says living humbly, living in the conditions of the poor, as it were. But he's talking about a place inside of you where you are open-hearted and where you embrace the other. Now, I went on, and people who know me in my later life ran Lucasfilm for many years, made Star Wars, Indiana Jones, all these kind of movies, and they'd say to me, you were in the Peace Corps? And they'd get this kind of confounded look on their face, like, how does someone who spent their career in the entertainment business be a returned Peace Corps volunteer? As if returned Peace Corps volunteers must go into helping professions or doctors or nurses or you name it, but something that seems more consistent with what people who go into the Peace Corps should be doing. But in fact, as everyone or the returned volunteers in the room know, returned Peace Corps volunteers are hardware salesmen, they're insurance salesmen, they're doctors, they're doing every profession, farmers, that are a part of American life. Jack Kennedy said, when he said goodbye to one of the first troops, one of the first groups going overseas, and some of his aides were saying, isn't this wonderful? 45 now are going overseas. And he looked at him and he said, I want 100,000 volunteers a year so that in 10 years there'll be 1 million returned volunteers and we'll finally have the basis for a sound American foreign policy. And so what you see in someone like Kennedy's comment is he's saying, I'm not expecting these people to come back and work in the State Department. I'm expecting them to return to their communities, to go back to the farms where they came from or something, and the small neighborhoods, and to continue to express in their lives what it means that they experienced as being a Peace Corps volunteer. So let me, one final thought, or second to the last final thought. So I ran Lucasfilm, and many of my employees used to say to me, oh, you're just running Lucasfilm as if it was your African village. And I always thought that was an interesting comment because I had no consciousness of doing that. And yet, every year I had a company meeting. And as part of the company meeting, what I would focus on is, what is the job of every employee? The job of every employee is to serve. You're going to serve the shareholders, which happened to be Mr. Lucas, but you're going to share your colleagues, you're going to serve your colleagues, and you're going to serve yourself. But when you come to work in the morning, your job is about service. And what does that mean? That means if you're serving your colleague, you're going to interact with that colleague in a different way. You're not going to, if you're getting into issues with them, you know, as I would say to them, you sit down with that person, you don't badmouth them. You sit down, you be direct, be specific, and be non-punishing. But you interact with that person and you work it out. Because they're your peer, they're your equal, no matter if it's me who sits sort of at the top or it's some assistant working in the accounts payable department. And I had a friend who was a classmate of mine in college, Daniel Goleman, who wrote a number of books about emotional intelligence. And I think what Dan was talking about was he even included me in his book and talking about what I was doing at Lucas. But that, again, what I'm trying to say is that every return volunteer is taking this wisdom they learn from Peace Corps and applying it to what they do. I call it the how, not the what. It doesn't matter what return Peace Corps volunteers do. They're going to do it in a way that's been infused and impacted by this experience. And it's not an experience that's easy to share. You can't, return volunteers can, it's a tough thing to communicate to someone else what it's like to live on this very basic level with others who are very different from you. But it sits inside of you like a jewel. And it absolutely informs everything that you do. Let me close. I mentioned Peace Corps as an institution and as a set of ideals. And the Congresswoman alluded to the fact that the House, just passed a unanimous resolution, bipartisan, both sides of the aisle, for a commemorative in Washington. This is something that's been a personal mission of mine for 25 years. The Senate needs to pass this, unfortunately, before the Congress adjourns. But what this commemorative is about the fundamental American ideals which are inherent in Peace Corps service. Peace Corps was the first government institution in the history of our nation to be based on those ideals, and to have our mission fulfilled not through bureaucrats, not through civil servants, not through diplomatic corps, but through common American citizens volunteering 2 years out of their life without pay to go overseas in service to these ideals. Only America could have created an institution like this. And I think America needs to celebrate and honor those ideals. We have a wonderful mall in Washington celebrating and honoring important values in our life, courage, sacrifice, valor. But I don't think they tell a complete story of what the American character is all about. And I think Peace Corps is really a lot, if not all, it is certainly a great part of what it is in the soul of the American character. Thank you.
But I also want to thank the CAP Center. I think one of the great privileges in my path coming out of the Peace Corps was that I was hired after I left Peace Corps, being a volunteer. I'd gone to law school first, and I ended up joining the Peace Corps because a lot of the people in the law firm where I was working, they were like drinking a little too much, their marriages were falling apart, and they were kind of coming to me a little summarizing depositions and saying, I don't know if I like my job, what did I, you know, how's law school going for you, Thomas? And I'd say, fine. So do you think you guys want to hire me? He said, what do you want to work here for? You can't. So a lot of these people kind of in the, this is in the 80s, and so the practice of law looked much less appealing in the face of it than actually the study, the elevated sense of law. You know, all the great people in books were lawyers, so I didn't realize it was a trade school. When you get there, it's like, you know, plumbing. So, and the job didn't look all that appealing, so and every time I mentioned, well, you know, I've thought about the Peace Corps, and everyone said, geez, I wish I would have done the Peace Corps. You know, so that way actually made it easy, and I knew at the time if I didn't do it then, I probably wouldn't do it at any point. So although I think it's a bad career path, I don't recommend it. I did join the Peace Corps after having taken the bar and went to Thailand, was an English teacher in the most remote place of Thailand. It's never still yet been discovered since I left, actually. So it was on the near the Thai, Lao, and Cambodian borders in the northeast, kind of the poor rural area of Thailand. And promptly forgot everything I learned while studying for the bar, but did learn pretty rapidly just the effect of U.S. national policy. This was 86 to 88, and the Farm Bill of 1985 had been enacted. And I remember my Thai, did anyone serve in Thailand? Oh, great. So my Thai is perfectly flawlessly accentless fluent. But at the time, and frankly, you know, I was impressed with Gordon was talking about what a good African dancer he was. Now, I've been around long enough to think, if you're not wearing a knee brace, someone's going to say, let's bust out a few moves there, Gordon. So the fact that he's, you know, so that maybe that's for later. None of you serve in Thailand, right? All right, okay, so I'm still fluent. So at the time, however, I realized my Thai wasn't very good, and someone was yelling at me when I was eating dinner at a little sidewalk cafe, and I didn't know how to say I'm sorry, so I was saying that repeatedly, and the other people, one of the other teachers at the school said, oh, he's just mad because, you know, he hasn't made money this year. And I said, well, why is that? He said, well, President Reagan in the Farm Bill of 1985, no idea what he was talking about. So as it turned out, you know, the farm subsidies that are still in existence had caused, there are a lot of rice farmers in California, so to support the price for American farmers, it ended up in a country where at the time 70% of the population were subsistence rice farmers. The effect of a bill that gets very little attention kind of in the national press had the effect of having 70% of the people in Thailand make zero money. I had no idea. I thought I was fairly, you know, well in tune with events before I left. I was in law school and that sort of thing, but that one, boy, the effect of the Farm Bill of 1985 creating some price support for American-grown rice had that consequential effect on millions of people in rural Thailand. It was a big eye-opener to me that, you know, the effects of what members of Congress do with not enough time and not enough and under all sorts of pressure and everyone yelling at them, sometimes it has much more far-reaching consequences than we fully appreciate. And I'm sure Sarah, you know, it must be weird to be in Kandahar and listening to all the experts that Gordon was talking about who can comment so thoughtfully, have never been there, don't understand what's going on, and the consequence on people's lives is profound. And I think that was one of to get that ground's eye view of world events as they unfold as a Peace Corps volunteer, it's really a privilege. It's very rare that such opportunities exist even today. You know, it's much different than, going on vacation and coming back, and you know, no one wants to look at your pictures, and they, you know, say, kind of, how was it? And you say, great. But after 2.5 years, to have the privilege of seeing how life unfolds in this, and the consequences of the ripple effect of policy decisions made far away, it's very powerful. So for me, it was kind of an inspiration to after I completed the Peace Corps service, which was great, to come back and had the experience of being hired by our then home state senator from California, Alan Cranston, who'd been the chief water carrier for the Peace Corps legislation from 1968 on. So, and he was the chief water carrier in the Senate because before he was elected to the Senate, Sarge Shriver had said, Alan, why don't you go out and do a little investigative reporting on the Peace Corps and just report back to me. So he was an auditor, basically, before that sort of thing was made illegal. Now we have inspectors general and that sort of thing. But he would hire journalists to go out and kind of write a report, an expose about how it was going and report back to him. Cranston was one of them. He was very impressed by what he saw in the early 60s, came back and was a fan ever since then. So coming back from, you know, rural Thailand and as a teacher, and going to the Senate, Peace Corps was great training because, you know, one of the big things about the Peace Corps is everything is culturally embedded. How you eat, how you sit, how you conduct yourself, how you dress, people are going to form a judgment about you. So just be super sensitive to the context you're in, because, you know, America is a kind of a low-context culture. It's like, hey, what's going? Get to the bottom line. What's happening? In other places, you just don't do that. It's rude. It's offensive. So I think in Thailand, it's got its own particular set of cultural cues that you have to learn or you're going to fail. Probably, as both in Malawi and Afghanistan and Morocco, there's just a way of conducting yourself. So, and you're aware that you don't know it until you learn it. So coming from the Peace Corps into the United States Senate, and Lois can appreciate this, I thought, wow, this is bizarre. What a weird cultural context. These people are, first of all, really weird, and they're all chiefs, you know? So for me, it was sort of like, okay, I get this, you know, and you just kind of learn how to conduct yourself. So it was a weird cross-cultural experience, but the Peace Corps had trained me well to be, you know, a lawyer in the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. One of the people, when the first Gulf War broke out, I was still a lawyer in the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, and talking with folks about, you know, what's going to happen, you know, because we're always bad at kind of... you look in the rearview mirror and not going to make that mistake again. And for the Veterans Administration, the Department of Veterans Affairs, that I was one of the counsels kind of trying to do the oversight and policy, I thought, wow, so if past is prologue, we're going to miss something big here in the Gulf War in terms of the veteran services. What's it going to be? It turned out there were a lot of women who'd served, a lot of reservists who'd been called up. The country and the VA wasn't prepared. But one of my colleagues said, there's a guy in Santa Barbara you need to talk to, Walter Capps. So, I called him, Professor Capps, I'm Thomas Tighe, and said, how is Alan? What can I do for you? The nicest guy. And I thought, we're just trying to figure out what we're missing. And he could not have been more gracious for a young, clueless staff member to say, I'll think about it and get back to you, but was able to get back with very good insights from his own experience and involvement in thinking and research and experience with the Vietnam and post-Vietnam experience. So for me to be here under the auspices of the CAP Center is something special, because he was a special man. And he had the good grace to marry a wonderful woman who has a tough job. But thank you, Lois, for your service, because that's absolutely important. So, you know, my path, and I think, you know, people are always, no one wants to hear my stories about the Peace Corps any more than you want to see my pictures. But if you do, I have millions that have been in boxes. But I think just the going from the Peace Corps to the Senate and then becoming really by default, not because there's a lot of competition, the person in the Senate who was charged with knowing all this Peace Corps legislative stuff. Because Cranston had, in the course of his career, hired two former general counsels of the Peace Corps who had helped write the Peace Corps Act, had helped form all the legislation. We still had all the archives, many of the working papers from every piece of legislation that had been enacted since 1961. Bill Josephson and some of these major architects who were just brilliant in conceiving the agency started aiming all their ideas at me, so I got to memorize the Peace Corps Act in triplicate. And that was how I ended up back at the Peace Corps. 6 years after I'd been a volunteer, plugging me in as the chief operating officer was great because it was still fresh enough in a way. But I realized, oh, my God, I'm now a suit from Washington. I'm now an idiot. I mean, I won't know anything. Here I am in headquarters. And the thing I loved about the Peace Corps that I think has really influenced my, you know, how I worked at the Peace Corps when I became the first chief operating officer, just so I basically to have line authority over all the crap that comes up, that the director's not, you know, you don't want the director spending his time on what, you know, just the kind of stuff that happens, to have that vision and get it out there. But someone needs to kind of try to run the organization to the extent it can be run. And one of the great things about the Peace Corps was that there's absolutely zero deference to authority. So it's great that the military hired you, probably because in the Peace Corps, you know, I had a nice office and I got promoted and someone would be on medevac and come back and say, hey, yeah, do you work here? It's like, yeah. Well, let me tell you, you're an idiot. And let me tell you, my country director is an idiot and they're totally screwed up and here's what you need to do. And I just love that. So we started, and they're often right. You know, they're just like you were when you were a volunteer, let's be honest, right? Everything that should be done. So every week we'd have a lunch in the big conference room at the Peace Corps with everyone who was on medevac status, because it was the only time you actually hear what's going on. By the time anything gets back to Washington, it's been filtered and filtered, and the good news kind of is kind of emphasized, and there are footnotes that explain, well, other things didn't work out quite as planned. So those are the things you form your judgments on. So I think the volunteers' experience and the lack of deference to authority within the organization is actually a very healthy thing. There were times I thought, well, God, military officer, that would people actually salute and do what you say? That must be great, because the Peace Corps, it's like, yeah, prove it to me that I should do that. And that's a good thing, ultimately. And I think the brilliance of Shriver and company, Kennedy and having the idea, and Shriver, you know, God forbid everyone who's had to follow him, because that energy and that vision and the combination of thinking big but thinking critically at the same time is something that's almost entirely lost in our country, I think. It's things become a religious divide. You either believe in the purpose and the higher level engagement in Afghanistan, and if you do, you do not question whether it's going right or wrong. If you believe in tax cuts, it doesn't matter what the economists say or what the facts are, you will find the thing that supports the view you previously held. And I think that if you look back, and I looked at all the archives, one of the great things about the Peace Corps is they were not at all hidebound. They were trying to go big, and if it screwed up, they'd say, well, you know, that didn't work. Punt on that. But do not defend on principle something that is indefensible in practice, because that will ruin support for the principle. And I thought that was a great kind of example that is so rare. Cranston actually had it. I think one of the things that he passed on was do not defend on principle something that you cannot defend in practice, because over the course of time, it erodes support for the principle. So Peace Corps was a good idea. Is it still a good idea? Is it something that in practice works? And that was my job for 5 years, and I think I'm a huge biased supporter. I think it needs to grow. I think it should be actually twice as big. I think it probably financially deserves about $1 billion a year, based on what I know the other money in the account is spent on. It is much, and I think Sarah has a much bigger sense, if you pay $300 to deliver a gallon of fuel to Kandahar to support the U.S. military, I mean, it's a lot of money to do some of the stuff we're doing, and it's not having the intended effect that it's having. So I think dollars to dollars, apples to apples, the investment in the Peace Corps, it's about $1 a year a citizen. Even if it's $450 million, we have 350 population. It's really maybe the only thing. Are any people friends of groups like Friends of the Peace Corps, Friends of Benin? Okay. Like, there's no Friends of OSHA. You know, it's like the one federal agency. I don't know how that happened, but this bipartisan tradition is great. And I think it does stand for, as Gordon was saying, a larger proposition that somewhere in this, as we look in the mirror as Americans, we do see this, on the one hand, the rugged cowboy who rides off alone at the sunset, but you also see a good neighbor. And I think it's Peace Corps, weirdly, perhaps more than anything else, reconciles these two competing elements of our national psyche, kind of the lonesome cowboy but the compassionate neighbor. And I think it's still current. I think the currency and the idea is still strong. Working now for 20 years at the policy level of international development as a CEO of an NGO that's about as big as the Peace Corps is right now in terms of revenue, you know, it's certainly circumstances have changed, and the notion that because it was good in 1961, it should still be good now is not true. It's not true. It's a bad argument. I think it's important now because it works now. It's the only thing that puts Americans in either a non-competitive way or, you know, I think if you meet someone in a business dealing, you have to be arm's length. You're trying to get something done. Gord, I'm sure, made big deals to distribute Indiana Jones in Japan. It's a different way to meet someone than if you meet them, you're just working alongside them, trying to support them, trying to work alongside them. And that's a great thing about the Peace Corps, the engagement with, in 1961, the diplomatic tool, you had diplomacy and military and nothing else. And you could kind of give money to governments. So the creativity in coming up with the idea of a people-to-people program, not a government-to-government program, was profound. A government-sponsored volunteer effort. And as I look forward, so it's really influenced how I view the pragmatism that's inherent in the Peace Corps, kind of the idealistic spark that I think is still an important, it energizes the Peace Corps. The fuel of the Peace Corps is still in the power of the idea and the notion of altruism. But the reality of the Peace Corps has to work. And I think that it's worked as well as it has, that people, such impressive people, continues to recruit talent and represent our people well. I mean, governments, whether it's Obama or Bush, that's, you know, they have a lot of pressures to act. The governments are going to have to make decisions that governments have to make. Interest rates, debt exchanges, trade policy. That's different than what the American people are all about. So I think, and I'm sure Sarah and Gordon have had this experience, as have many of you. So you're American? We hate filling the president's name, but we like the people, you know? And that's true. I mean, I think for those of you who traveled around enough, as you have, you understand that. And finally, I think for me, one of the most powerful things that you pick up in the Peace Corps that you otherwise don't is just how wonderfully evenly distributed talent is in this world and how wonderfully inadequately opportunity is distributed in this world. There were people in every one of your villages who were smart or probably smarter than you were, right? Certainly it was true in my case. There were students that, in my case, who just happened to be born in, you know, Sisaket, Thailand, whose statistical chances of advancing, making money, having the kind of either possessions or quality of life that they dreamed about were very low. But it was not because they lacked the inherent ability. I mean, I think that was one of the powerful things that all folks that I've met in Peace Corps is just how great, I mean, we're a great species, right? We kill each other and do stupid things, but actually, we're pretty cool. We don't eat our young, usually. There is this notion of empathy and compassion that does distinguish us from other, most other mammals, not all, but it's, you know, it's a cool quality, and you see the intellectual, that evolution is working. With all apologies to people who don't believe in evolution, but I think it's working and we're kind of aiming in the right direction. And some of these altruistic notions are essential to that. So to be able to see how the talent of our species is so evenly distributed and how awful it is that girls mainly don't have the opportunities to realize their inherent potential, how hard life is in 2010, it's still inspiring for me to get up, go to direct relief, and try to do what we can to address some of the very basic, still immense health challenges that exist. And that came from the Peace Corps. I would have not probably realized it as rapidly as I did or wanted to do anything about it, but it's a good fight worth having. And I'll close with something I just think, you know, Gordon had raised the policy issue, and but I think if you, you know, I don't think the Peace Corps has any exclusivity on altruism or as an ability. There are great people here in Santa Barbara who set up NGOs, do extraordinary things. But there's no channel. There's way more capacity in our country among the people than there are opportunities to channel it. So I think the challenge for the Peace Corps, we have people, and I'm sure all of you who work in NGOs, people want to volunteer. How can I get involved? How can I serve? Often now you say, well, we're doing a fundraiser in 3 weeks, if you know, you know, and that's just part of it. But really, the talent that exists in our communities and the desire to have some of this talent shared in a productive way on a personal level, it's that in itself is still just a huge opportunity. So I think the Peace Corps is far too small it's kind of hostage to its experience as an organization and the historical funding levels, and you can get back to 1961 and look at the chart. It's ridiculous. We have millions of people who want to serve, who need to serve, who have the talents and skills, who could engage with the kind of things that Sarah and Greg Mortensen and other folks who kind of engage at the community level. It's different than NGOs trying to do professional development work, which often means telling people what they already know how to do, they just don't have the money to do it. But Peace Corps is a great vehicle that could, I think, justify, you know, far greater, it could recruit and attract far greater talent than it has, and I think it's something that it's a great antidote for many of the things that still confront this world. So I have no idea when I was invited if that had anything to do with what I was supposed to talk about, but I had fun. So thank you very much for inviting me.
From soon after its inception, the Peace Corps was infiltrated and cynically manipulated by the Central Intelligence Agency. This was the very same governmental agency that was instrumental in the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. We have seen how the company, as it is colloquially known, has helped to destroy the integrity of the mainstream media and foster disillusionment amongst the American
populace. Sir, I'm going to have to ask for the question.
Here's the question. What can we say about the quality of the Peace Corps today to the enthusiastic, good-hearted, high-minded idealists that wish to make a positive impact on the global scene? Thank you.
You directing this to any of the panelists?
I think Sarah could answer that question very well.
Look, on the assumption upon which the question was based, I'd like to challenge it. At least in my experience as a Peace Corps volunteer, not only was there no sign of any involvement by the CIA, but we were in fact told that we were entirely independent of any government agency whatsoever, and should somebody from the U.S. Embassy show up outside our house, we were perfectly within our rights to tell them to get back in the car and go away. So that's at least the degree of independence that I experienced in the Peace Corps, and for me that's really critical. And again, lack of respect for authority, you know, whatever you like, that no restraint on what anybody said about anything, about their experience as a volunteer, about what was going on in the country, about the impact of U.S. policy in that country. So I think, you know, again, based on my experience, the Peace Corps is a remarkably independent institution for something that does, in fact, belong to the United States government.
Yeah, if I could just thank you. Yeah, you know, one of the things I did on the staff is, particularly this issue. You know, when we had signed an agreement to begin the program in the People's Republic of China, it was Cold War rhetoric. And it was not supported by the facts, including the archives and everyone who's done research into kind of the CIA involvement. There were some allegations. I think the main case that kind of fostered a lot of that was a guy named Edwin Lee Howard, who actually post-Peace Corps service, there's a cooling-off period, joined the Peace Corps, and then he defected in the 80s to Russia. And he ultimately, I think he's now dead. But that did kind of fuel a lot of the things that had always been said. When we signed the agreement in... we were going to set up the program in Cambodia. I went there to do it. My father had been killed in Vietnam when I was a little boy. He was a career military officer. So it was sort of weird for me to be there and seeing the announcement by the then Khmer Rouge radio that the CIA-fronted Peace Corps is now here trying to re-exert its authority. It was absurd then. I think there's no factual basis for that other than Edwin Lee Howard. And in fact, even remote family members of CIA employees have to, if they're going to apply for a Peace Corps, so if your uncle is a senior official at the Peace Corps and you don't know it, actually there's a protocol where they have to disclose it to the Peace Corps, and then there's a judgment that has to be made whether or not that disqualifies the Peace Corps from any association with intelligence. So I think having looked at it both inside on the Hill with the as a subpoena power and that sort of stuff, if there ever was that notion, the risk to people who are living out on their own is very high. So it is a bedrock principle, the Peace Corps, and I think you just have your facts wrong, sorry to say.
Let me just add one final thought there, which is that Yes, number one, the CIA was never involved. The CIA, the Peace Corps, was never from the very beginning an instrument of American foreign policy. And that was an issue when the creation of the Peace Corps that got heavily debated. And Peace Corps got pulled out of the Department of State for just that reason and remains an independent agency. But when you also think of the fact, and this is what's most amazing to me about Peace Corps as an institution, the trust the American government has given to Peace Corps volunteers to put them in the field, largely unsupervised, for 2 years to interact directly with host country nationals is an amazing trust. And there's no way the government knows on a day-to-day basis what you're doing, what you're saying, and yet throughout the world, this has worked. And it's worked because our American government said, we trust our American citizens to work unsupervised in a way that will not embarrass us or, more importantly, will not undermine us as a political entity. And I'd say most Peace Corps volunteers, if not all Peace Corps volunteers, are not flag wavers. They're there not as Americans, but as individuals. They are Americans, but they're first there working on a human level.
I have two questions. One to Sarah, very interested in what you might tell General Petraeus that you might be able to share with us, but certainly, obviously, there are things you can't. But my understanding is that there's a major concern about having our military presence in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan. Hopefully, we're removing some of that in Iraq right now. But that the power of the NGOs in Afghanistan and other parts of the world has been very, very successful and productive in addressing some of the issues there. I'm wondering, my first question deals specifically, is would having a greater Peace Corps presence be an improvement or be helpful in creating a much more favorable environment in Afghanistan for the people of Afghanistan as well as the American relationship with Afghanistan. The second question goes to the whole notion that public service back in the days of JFK, when many of us were alive and were called to that service, was very honored. There's a sense, as I've observed the world today, where public service is more vilified than honored. And I'm wondering if there's anything that you suggest we can do to bring more people to realize that the Peace Corps is honored service, both for them, for ourselves as individuals, and to demonstrate the values that make this country great. If you could respond to those.
On the first one, unequivocally, yes. In other words, would it be helpful to have Peace Corps volunteers in Afghanistan? Unequivocally, yes. But let me back up to your assumption again and say that one of the things that I found most remarkable in Afghanistan, I, you know, was in Kandahar in December 2001, and we and our military presence were welcomed because the Afghan population had been through 25 years of conflict, had turned to the Taliban in 1994 not out of religious extremism or fanaticism, but because they had lived through a period of violent chaos caused by, and you know, again, another thing that I could talk for 20 minutes about, but the Soviets withdrew in 1989, and the rest of the world basically turned to the Iron Curtain and those sorts of issues, and you had essentially military commanders. What you had was a society suffering collective PTSD that turned its post-traumatic stress disorder, that turned its the skills that it had learned during combat upon itself. And so you had a kind of, in Kabul, you had very large-scale factional civil war. Down in Kandahar, what you had, what people would, I remember asking someone, wasn't Gulagha Shirzai the governor of Kandahar before the Taliban? And the person told me, well, yeah, in the governor's palace. And three or four blocks away, you had a guy with 10 fighters, and he was governor of his street corner. And if you had three or four fighters with guns, you were governor of your street corner. There was a degree of violent chaos that was just almost impossible for us to understand. And the Taliban represented a government structure. It might not have been the one that the people would have ideally aspired to, but it was something. And so what they saw in us when we came in 2001 was, oh, thank God, the international community is coming here to help us build a decent and responsive government that's not religiously fanatic. And what's incredibly ironic is what we did was a sort of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So who was it who hated the Taliban most? It was the criminal warlords who the Taliban drove out of Afghanistan in 1994. So those were the guys we brought back in and empowered. And that is why the population of Afghanistan has come to resent us. Not because of a military footprint per se, because this is a culture that, you know, or I won't say a culture, I'll say it's a society that because of 25 years of conflict does know that you need to have someone at your back, as it were, meaning power, to impose some order on things. But it's the way, again, the how that you were talking about, Tom, the way that we have done this has been to put our, and unwittingly, to be honest, at least for a while, for most of the time, it's been unwittingly, we've put our power at the service of largely government officials that were largely these actors who were not the ones that the Afghan population most wanted to see return to power. And this is where we come to the issue of government versus non-government. Governments tend to interact with governments. And so that's some of the frustration that I've sometimes experienced with some U.S. officials, is that they don't sit with the people. They don't interact with the people, so they actually don't understand what the people think or feel and why they're, and the degree of their rage and what are the motivations that cause them to join a violent resistance. And what they do is interact with and take on board the language of government officials. And so it's precisely to counteract that tendency to only listen to the government and become sort of government-centric counterinsurgency rather than population-centric counterinsurgency or population-centric understanding that I think the Peace Corps would be a phenomenal addition thing to be in Afghanistan. Now, the level of violence is such that it would be a problematic issue. Now, what was your second question, which I'll answer quicker?
About trying to restore a sense of public service.
Right. Well, again, I mean, what's been so interesting is to watch, and my current boss was in Afghanistan recently and had a open house at the embassy, and one of the questions was about the militarization of American foreign policy. And he says, I'm devastated by it. I'm distraught by this. I'm not sure he used those precise words, but he said, I'm concerned about this. But he talked about it as a generational issue. Because of what has happened to civilian public service in this country over the last 20 years, there's been a hiring freeze. It's now finished, but there was a 9-year hiring freeze in the State Department. And one embassy official told General McChrystal early on in his command, we have no colonels. I am part of an organization that is missing its middle management. At my high school, somebody was quite worried about a high school. I went back to give a talk, and a teacher came to me very upset about the notion that a senior wanted to go to West Point. And I said, well, actually, currently, if you want to be involved in what the United States is doing overseas, West Point isn't a bad idea, and A. And B, as an American citizen, I want smart people in my military, so I'm not going to dissuade him from doing this. But what I would love to see is the State Department as sexy, as self-reflective, as much of a learning organization as the military is, and I don't really see that happening.
I wanted to ask you about, kind of on her question, I hire engineers, and one of the things we do is we have them fill out this I-9 form and these other pieces of paperwork, and a lot of the paperwork always calls for what kind of military experience have you had in your life, and to me that's fine, but I'm thinking that if you want to get more than just the commemorative that might happen in Washington, D.C., if you want to get people to think about other things they can do with life, then on those kind of forms, the policy level, say, well, what did you do civil service? Did you have any Peace Corps? you know, get people to just see that question, even if they can't answer it. So do you think that'll happen in our lifetime?
I can. Yeah, from my perspective, I tell people, and I teach over the grad school at UCSB, and I still, you know, it's a terrible thing to say, but I do think that the notion that if you take 9 months of area studies and write a paper, that you will be deemed to have an advanced degree, and Peace Corps service counts as less than that. I think it's at least equivalent to an MA program, if not more so. And I think the employers, people who, and I think they actually do recognize that, and I think those of us who, people in your position, should value it as much, because forget about what the form is, you're making the hiring decision. So I think the more people can recognize that, that does have a self-effectuating effect, the more people who do it, it's like, oh, because right now, now college degrees, people think, I work with great, great young talented people who are smart and nailing it, and they think, I have to go to grad school. And I thought, why? They said, well, because everyone, you have to. And the Peace Corps has not kind of gotten that public cachet. I think from a legislative perspective, there are certain things, military service. Peace Corps has always been careful about equating itself to military service. It was never an exemption from the draft, big myth of the Peace Corps. They affirmatively stated it was never. But I think they don't want to get into the position of saying, yeah, it's just like the military. It's different. And I think they've been very respectful of military service. All the people who set it up served in World War II. And so I think that piece of it, what on the federal forms is going to be disclosed and is it going to be ranked in the same way, I doubt that, frankly. But that doesn't prevent the goal inherent in your question, how can Peace Corps service be enhanced and respected both as a credential, and I think to Hannah Beth's question, absolutely. I mean, the reason you have governments is to get to scale. Governments are the only things that can work at the scale. And the military is the only direct-run government entity, and VA, actually. But otherwise, the government is setting policy and paying stuff. They're not running things anymore. And I think it's so NGOs who take government money to do similar work, it's great, but it does hollow out the ability to actually bring a volunteer corps to scale. And that's what's lacking, which is I would love to see the money that gets farmed out to great NGOs come back into the Peace Corps, because it can attract the same talent. But that's that was actually not answering your question at all. But again, I felt good about what I said. Thank you.
I'd like to ask the three of you to comment on something, and it's a question to take back that Lois can take back to Washington. And it follows up kind of on what Assemblywoman Jackson was asking. 2 years ago, there was a very bright college professor from the South Side of Chicago, and one of his key campaign planks was restoring programs and expanding them for national service. And he specifically mentioned the Peace Corps, and he mentioned public service domestically. Right now, the hottest topic in Washington seems to be whether people who are making, in some cases, $1 million a day need to have a tax break. And Tom has pointed out that
question.
The question is, why can't we find the money to go from $1, $1.25 a day per American to $2 or $3 a day to make groups like the Peace Corps happen? And what happened to that commitment from the new administration to promote national service? Where is that?
Who would like this?
I'll take the first jump at this. And Tom mentioned it either in his remarks or in answering a question. The current budget of Peace Corps is actually literally being discussed right now. Last year it was $400 million. You know, it is, as they say, of such small amount that it's a rounding error within the Department of State's budget. So that's the trivial nature of the dollars. And yet the irony is both sides of the aisle will look at Peace Corps as one of the most efficient uses of our dollars on a cost-benefit analysis. Again, Tom mentioned that in his remarks. So the irony is both sides of the aisle like it. It's a small amount. So what happens? Well, what happens, unfortunately, is, I think, two things that go on. One is, as inevitably seems to happen in Washington, well, if we give the money to Peace Corps, then how do we not give it over here? There is this wonderful thought that everything should be treated alike, because if you start making exceptions, where do you end? The slippery slope kind of problem. Now, there's answers to that. And you can make distinctions, and we ask our legislators to make judgments, and that's essentially what this is asking for. But there's no question, Peace Corps, there are countries that want more volunteers. There are
qualified citizens that can be volunteers, and it's just a question of resources. Obama, to his credit, has continued to ask for more money from Peace Corps, from Congress. And unfortunately, it's not been the House. The problem, it seems to be in all situations these days, is the Senate. And the Senate is just not giving the money. It's hard to figure out why, but anyways.
Did either one of you want to comment on this?
Yeah, I mean, my only point was, yeah, it's a dollar a year per citizen, not a dollar a day. That would be $365 a day times 300 million. I mean, the Peace Corps is a dollar, what, 2 cents a day then to get to $400 million. And there's nothing that cheap in Washington. Just it's a, but I do think that I personally, having been the person who tried to fight that for both in working in the Senate as a staffer and on the Hill, you get hostage to the base. You get hostage to your experience, and you just look at last year, next year, and what percentage up or down. So it prevents you from seeing what the potential really is. And I think they put so many. Had to push so hard on some of the other stimulus efforts that were huge new numbers. I think the Peace Corps, if it could have got caught in that jet stream, they'd have been there now. They just didn't. They missed that opportunity, unfortunately.
I think I would actually like to add two words, which has to do with not only is public service not honored, but I actually think that it's become unfashionable to care in Washington. And I have to say that often or occasionally, someone will describe me as, quote, passionate or, quote, caring about the Afghan people. And believe me, neither of those epithets are necessarily positive. I have come to realize that if I want to influence the way the United States is behaving in Afghanistan, I have to put it in terms of what is likely to make us win. Right? Now, it so happens that I think that what is best for the Afghan people is going to produce the most positive outcome for U.S. national interests. But it's almost a taboo subject to talk in and of itself about what is good for the Afghan people. And so what I think also part of the problem for the Peace Corps is it's as though ethics, the notion of ethics in our foreign policy is a subject that you really can't address directly. The notion that our foreign policy ought to have an ethical basis is really a difficult one to promote in Washington.
Interesting. This will be our last question.
Thank you very much. I'm concerned from the host country's point of view. What is the difference of acceptance of American service, such as the Peace Corps, then, 35, 40 years ago, versus today?
I'm not sure. Are you asking, are as many countries now wanting Peace Corps volunteers as did in the early 60s?
Not necessarily how many countries, but the atmosphere, the desire to have us go there and serve. Public perception is that Americans are considerably less like today than they were 35 years ago. How does that affect your going to these countries?
Well, in terms of Peace Corps is now getting, again, requests for volunteers. We've just gone back into Colombia, where we had been, and then we had to leave because the Americans decided it was too dangerous and difficult. But I don't know, and I'm sure there probably are, of countries where Peace Corps is not wanted. I mean, Peace Corps is how can I say it? It's beyond politics to most host countries. They see it as helping them address needs that they have, and the people that run the countries feel like, in a sense, it's helping their agendas, their domestic agendas. So and they get it largely without cost. So it's sort of a win-win to them, and there's no reason, unless there's some sort of political agenda behind the scenes, to kind of say, oh, no, we don't want Peace Corps, or even not to step forward and ask for Peace Corps.
Yeah, and I think there's the kind of the political and kind of atmospherics of how American foreign policy is perceived. And it's really tough, I think, just because of the wars we've been fighting and some of the rhetoric that's been launched, that it's not perceived as, a religious war against Muslims, which is not, I think that just it's replete throughout Africa, where my organization works a lot. But even in Malawi, where we've been working with a group who set up the medical college of Malawi,
there's like one physician for every 10,000 people or something. It's a very low ratio. They do need the human resources that we have in abundance here. We really do. And I think the opportunity, so there's a desire for help. And I think there's a recognition that the Peace Corps really is what it says it is. It's not a stalking horse for something else. It's 50 years old. If the CIA had been using it, they would have at least tried once by now, you know. And so I think it's perceived as having done what it said it was going to do, being able to attract good people. And I think there really is a need for a reallocation of how we're spending our dollars and the opportunities our people have that would be deeply embraced, at least just on health, just in Malawi, just next year. They could use 500 physicians, nurses, health workers, lab techs to do all that training. That's one, without question, Uganda, Tanzania, I mean, all of these countries have a deep shortage of the human talent that Peace Corps, in part, is intended to address. So I think if it were I running things, it would be there would be a Peace Corps reestablished health unit that itself would have about 5,000 members of different professional strains involved in it within the next 2 years. And we could do that, no question.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.